You know, it's like the old Soviet joke when Gorbachev put the taps on vodka up, and the son says to his father, "So does this mean you're going to drink less?" And he says, "No, son, it means you're going to eat less."
Welcome to Wine and Health, a new podcast channel from Drinks Insider. In this occasional series, I'm going to do a deep dive into wine, health, and health policy. What do we know for certain, and what don't we know? And how is this information being used? Come on this journey into a world where evidence, uncertainty, and public health collide. Welcome to the Wine and Health Podcast. Today I'm speaking to Christopher Snowden, one of Britain's most outspoken critics of government intervention in areas like obesity, gambling and alcohol. An author and journalist, he's also the head of lifestyle economics at the Institute of Economic Affairs, which is a free market think tank. And he's a prolific blogger on issues from vaping to food policies. Now, just a word about the following conversation. In it, I briefly mentioned the MUC trial, which was a North American study that was going to look at whether moderate consumption of alcohol had any cardiovascular benefits, but it was shut down. We also talk about the work of Tim Stockwell, who is probably the most consequential figure in the alcohol debate at present, and I need to explain why. In the past 40 years, a number of observational studies have shown that light to moderate drinkers have better health outcomes in life than either heavy drinkers or people who don't drink at all, the abstainers. Professor Stockwell from the University of Victoria in Canada has published four separate papers dating back to 2006, where he has re-evaluated those studies. He says they don't adequately account for what's called the sick quitter phenomenon, the idea that maybe people abstain from alcohol because they're too sick to drink, and that's why their health outcomes appear worse than light to moderate drinkers. Tim Stockwell's work has had huge media traction and has done more than perhaps anything else to change the narrative around wine and health. Christopher Snowden has been a harsh critic of Stockwell's papers, and in this conversation, he explains why. I'm going to put all the relevant papers and articles in the show notes, and also stay tuned. In the next episode of the Drinks Insider Wine and Health podcast, Tim Stockwell responds to his critics. As always, the takeaways are available to subscribers of the Drinks Insider newsletter, which you can sign up for at drinksinsider.com. Hi, Chris. It's great to see you.
Great to see you too.
Right, let's get into it. So you're the head of lifestyle at the Institute of Economic Affairs. What's the role and what is the Institute of Economic Affairs?
Institute of Economic Affairs, the IEA, is a free market think tank founded in the 1950s in London. And we look at public policy, generally speaking, current public policy issues through the lens of economics. The lifestyle economic stuff that I do is really kind of controversial lifestyle choices, usually involving public health opposition. So smoking, drinking, gambling, vaping, sugary drinks, food regulation, and that kind of thing is what I focus on. That's what I've been doing for the last 15, 20 years, although I've only been at the IEA since 2013.
So you're regularly called right-wing provocateur, libertarian, probably somebody will use the word fascist at some point.
Yeah.
Is any of this true?
Oh, libertarian is fairly, I mean, this is as good a word as any. I mean, we prefer just classical liberal or free market. I mean, it's really just about economics. You know, there's nothing particularly right-wing about economics, I don't think.
Well, okay, so the IEA receives funding from big business. So does this mean that you're just a cover for dangerous industries like alcohol and tobacco?
Well, I mean, no, obviously not, but I mean, people can say.
Well, hang on a second. What do you mean, obviously not? Why aren't you just a cover for dangerous big business?
Well, because I'm saying what I think. You know, I find it quite insulting when people suggest that you're saying whatever they imagine the people who fund you want to be said. We're a charity. We rely entirely on voluntary donations. I don't think much more than a quarter of our income actually does come from big business, and a lot of that is for sponsorship of events that are, public. I mean, that's the whole point of sponsoring these things. So, I'm not involved in the fundraising, but if the fundraisers go off and speak to people in industries that I write about, then that would be fair enough. And if they want to give us money, that's fantastic. But, we don't do any commissioned research or anything like that. It's simply a matter that if people like what we're saying, then we need them to support us because we can't exist otherwise. But, you know, we're very consistent in you know, the line we take on these things, a libertarian line, as you might say.
All right, so let's get into what it is that you talk about. You've got a blog, Velvet Fist Iron Glove, which which goes back many, many years, which I've spent quite a lot of time reading. And you have tracked the rise of what some people are now calling neo-prohibitionism. Can you talk specifically about alcohol and the types of changes in alcohol policy or alcohol thinking that you've seen in the last 15 years?
The last 15 years, you've just seen gradually more dogmatic approach to the issue, really. I mean, it's better really to look over the course of the last 100 or 200 years and see the gradual evolution of alcohol policy. I mean, let's go back, say, the last 100 years. 100 years ago, America was under prohibition. So were a number of other countries that, you know, famously fell apart and gave the temperance movement a bad name for a long time. And then we had a period of, I would say, relative lifestyle freedom in the West for the rest of the 20th century. Really, the temperance lobby was on the back foot. Saw a lot of the prohibitionist groups not disappear, but certainly change their image and often change their names. So the big temperance groups of the 19th century would be the International Order of Good Templars, which was kind of founded. Well, it was international, obviously, but particularly strong in Scandinavia. In the UK, you had the United Kingdom Alliance for the Suppression of Intoxicating Beverages. I think I got that right, although perhaps even longer name than that. I think the word traffic is in there as well, but basically a prohibitionist organization. And then in the 20th century, they had to water down their demands, basically. They realized that prohibition wasn't going to happen, but they wanted to bring in what you rightly call neo-prohibitionist policies. So this is kind of the boiling frog approach to alcohol, in which you focus particularly on things like advertising, on price, and on availability. So the International Order of Good Templars changed its name to the International Organization of Good Templars, then it changed its name to IOGT International, and then only a few years ago it changed its name to Mavendi. So at every point, the name kind of sounds a little bit less sinister, to the point where now Mavendi doesn't really mean anything at all, I don't think. It's just a kind of corporate-sounding name. The UK Alliance is an interesting one because they were they weren't successful in their political demands because the UK never had prohibition, but they prospered. And the temperance movement in the 19th century was a genuine grassroots movement, which it isn't now. And they bought up some property in central London, which is called Alliance House. It's still called Alliance House now. And it's commercial property. They just rent it out. And so the UK Alliance still exists. It's called the Alliance House Foundation. You can find them on the Charity Commission website. They get all their money from renting out property. And they give a lot of it to an organization called the Institute of Alcohol Studies, which is the successor to an organization called the UK Temperance Society, which the Alliance previously founded. So again, you see this watering down of the names from the UK Alliance for the Suppression of All Alcohol to the UK Temperance Society, the Institute of Alcohol Studies. The Alliance House Foundation, they actually share the building. They're in Alliance House with the Alliance House Foundation. And if you go on the Alliance House website, they're quite upfront about their history. They're very proud of their prohibitionist history, and they are still explicitly in favor of total abstinence. They just say that we think we can do this through, you know, voluntary measures now rather than legal coercion. So these guys are still around. The other one worth mentioning, a guy who must be about 90 now, I think, Derek Rutherford, I believe, mm-hmm. is still alive. So this guy joined the International Order of Good Templars when he was 9 years old in the 1930s. He's a Methodist, and he has been quite commendable, really. He's quite a character. You know, he's been fighting for temperance for most of the last 100 years. And he set up a whole network of international anti-alcohol organizations, too many to keep up with, really. But there's
Global Policy Alcohol
Alliance. Yeah, that's a big kind of umbrella one, he gets quite a bit of money from the European Commission. So he's got the Global Alcohol Policy Alliance, but he also set up Eurocare. There's one called Active Europe, or the European Active Sobriety Friendship. Numerous organizations. He was involved in some of the government's kind of public health bodies looking at alcohol in the 60s and 70s. And I don't know how involved he is still in the area, but certainly that network of state-funded temperance groups is still very much alive and influential.
Yes, he wrote a book, which I'll put in the show notes. This is a key point. How did what were temperance groups, many of which were religious temperance groups, transform themselves into NGOs and public health bodies? Do you know?
Well, it's a kind of long story. I think the short version is that in the mid-20th century, following the collapse of Prohibition, you had the alcoholism model of, you know, understanding alcohol as a kind of a public health issue. So the general belief was that alcoholism is a disease, that it doesn't affect that many people, and that the people it does affect, you know, need to be dealt with, you know, treatment, rehabilitation, insofar as that's possible. But they are a separate kind of group to your general responsible drinker. And then in the 1970s, you had a Finnish sociologist called Kjetil Bruun. And he was in was obviously in Finland, right? And Finland had prohibition until 1935, slightly longer than America did, actually. And then when prohibition collapsed in Finland, the government still had very, very strict alcohol policies. And I believe at that point there was still a sort of form of rationing went on with alcohol, and you could kind of have your ration book taken off you if you were caught being drunk and disorderly, this kind of thing. Now, Kjetil Bruun, he was no great fan of alcohol, but he didn't like what he saw as the government's punitive approach to the problem. In other words, he didn't think it was right to single out individuals who were alcoholics. This is a word now that kind of has gone out of public health. You're not supposed to use it, but I think since most people understand what it means, it's reasonable to use it. And indeed, the fact that it's now considered rather gauche to use it shows how much the Kjetil Bruun model has taken over. So Kjetil Bruun, he said that we shouldn't be stigmatizing people as he saw it, because this is a societal problem. You know, he's a sociologist. He sees this as being a problem in society, and that in effect, everybody is responsible. And the government in particular is responsible, because the government can do something about the alcohol industry, I guess, and the alcohol supply chain. So he believed that the solution was not to, as he saw it, to punish or stigmatize individuals, but to get everybody to drink less, and to have the government have quite strong control over the alcohol industry. Now, in Finland and several other Scandinavian countries, you have alcohol monopolies. Bruun's theory tied in very well with an emerging theory, also put about mainly by Scandinavian researchers, which is the idea of the collectivity of drinking cultures. This is a rather an odd idea, actually. But the basic gist of it is that the whole of society will drink more or drink less in concert. So because we all in some way affect each other's behavior, if moderate drinkers, for example, drink less, then heavy drinkers will also drink less. Everybody just moves in the same direction. Now, there was never any evidence for this, and it's kind of a weird thing to assume anyway. But what it did was that it meant that per capita alcohol consumption became the leading, it was portrayed as being the driver of heavy drinking, of alcohol-related problems, of alcohol-related deaths. And the key to tackling alcohol-related diseases and deaths became to bring down per capita consumption, which you can do, I guess, by, you know, putting high taxes on the products. And these guys think you can do it by restricting marketing and restricting licensing. But the idea is that, you know, if you get the average person to consume less alcohol, then the heavy drinkers will consume less alcohol
too. I should interject at this point. There's been a study done in the last couple of years in Yukon in Canada with trialing labels, putting, you know, alcohol causes cancer label warnings. And the researchers claim that the alcohol industry shut down that before they could finish the research, but putting labels on proved that people did drink less, that it did reduce consumption in the thing. But I've had a look at the paper, and what they don't tell you is who consumed less. There's no breaking down of whether it was heavy problem drinkers who were affected by that, or whether it was moderate drinkers who went, "Ooh, I don't want to get cancer."
Yeah.
And I was really struck by that. It seemed to me that if you were going to study that properly, you should at least be looking at who is drinking less. But I guess that ties into what you're saying about population level.
Yes. The same would be true of quite a lot of alcohol control policies. Minimum pricing in Scotland did seem to lead to a small reduction in per capita consumption, only something like 3%. But this was considered to be a victory, despite the fact that heavy drinkers didn't reduce their consumption. The harmful drinkers didn't reduce their consumption.
Yes, and not only that, wasn't there some evidence that they stopped buying food?
A little bit of that, yeah. There were unintended consequences. There was a bit of a shift from beer to spirits and from cider to spirits. So, you know, from a public health point of view, bearing in mind that alcohol-related deaths in Scotland are at a 14-year high at the moment, it's very hard to say that minimum pricing has worked. But if you just ignore harm, which is effectively what they do, and just focus on consumption and per capita consumption in particular, then you can portray these things as being a success. And it is probably true that sticking graphic warnings on the products and putting taxes up and minimum pricing and some of these other policies will reduce consumption, but you're probably going to do it amongst the people who are moderate drinkers. And most people could tell you, just using ordinary knowledge, as it were, that the people who are the heaviest drinkers are actually the least likely to cut down, not least because some of them are alcoholics and are therefore addicted.
Can you just explain what minimum pricing is?
Yeah, minimum pricing is where you put a floor price on a unit of alcohol. So in Scotland, it's 50p. It's actually just gone up to 65p because the policy has been such a tremendous success. But the idea is that you get rid of so-called cheap alcohol. And the advocates of this policy said, well, we know that alcoholics or dependent drinkers, whatever they call them these days, we know that these people tend to drink a disproportionate amount of cheap alcohol, particularly things like strong cider. So if we get rid of that through minimum pricing, then they'll stop drinking. This is the kind of boneheaded mentality that you're dealing with there. Now, most people, without any, you know, PhDs to their name, would say, I don't think that's going to happen. I think what's going to happen is that these people are going to spend less money on other things. You know, it's like the old Soviet joke when Gorbachev put the tax on vodka up, and the son says to his father, so does this mean you're going to drink less? And he says, no, son, it means you're going to eat less.
Oh, I mean, I shouldn't laugh at that joke. But, okay, so do you have any ideas about what a rational alcohol policy would look like? I mean, given that there are people who are harmed by excessive consumption, what's the evidence about how to deal with it?
Well, the things that seem to work above all are treatments. You know, I mean, the so-called disease model of alcohol actually seems to have a lot more going for it than the public health model of alcohol. These broad brush policies like restricting advertising, I mean, it's very clear, actually, I published something about this last year. It's very clear that banning alcohol advertising really doesn't make any difference to anything, you know, other than perhaps market share, but it doesn't reduce harm. Almost no studies have even looked at that. It doesn't even reduce consumption. So these things don't work very well. What does definitely work, and I think everybody would agree with this, is treatment. So in the UK and many other countries, we saw a big spike in alcohol-related deaths during the pandemic, which has still not actually gone back down to normal, even now, unfortunately, although it probably will do in time, I think. Now, there's two reasons for that, I would suggest. One is that people were locked up at home and felt very, you know, lonely and were in despair. And the other is that people who were needing treatment for their alcohol dependency couldn't get it or couldn't get it face-to-face. And those two things combined led to a big spike in alcohol-related deaths, which all the evidence shows is due to heavy drinkers drinking more, even though, and this is an important point, bear in mind what we've just been discussing, even though per capita consumption went down. in the UK and many other countries.
Okay, interesting.
You also saw, by the way, you know, there was much less alcohol advertising during the pandemic. I don't know if you noticed this, but spirits advertising in particular gave up because all the pubs and clubs were closed. There's no point advertising these things that you're primarily trying to get people to try these drinks in pubs and clubs and restaurants. There was also a massive reduction in availability, which is supposed to be one of the big drivers of alcohol-related harm, because the pubs and the clubs and the restaurants were all shut, so you could only go to the off-license. And in some countries, couldn't even do that. And there was no change in price. So we saw, I guess in a way that's consistent with this small decline in consumption, right? That advertising fell and availability fell and there was a decline in consumption. What it's not consistent with is a decline in harm, because harms went up massively. The number of deaths went through the roof. And basically moderate drinkers drank less, heavy drinkers drank more, to put it in simple terms. So the population didn't move in concert. This idea that there's this kind of single distribution of alcohol consumption is nonsense. It never had any evidence to support it, other than the kind of very mundane observation that because heavy drinkers drink a vastly disproportionate quantity of alcohol, which is always portrayed as being some horrendous thing, but actually is what you see in most markets. It's called the Pareto principle, the 80-20 rule, that 20% of your consumers consume 80% of the product, because most consumers are not that bothered about it, but that is true of alcohol as it is other things. And therefore, if you have fewer heavy drinkers, you will see a reduction in per capita consumption. That is absolutely plausible. The trouble is, it doesn't work if you try and reverse engineer that, or if you try and push it in the other direction. So if you just say that because there is this kind of sort of slightly spurious link between per capita consumption and heavy drinking, yes, if you have fewer heavy drinkers, you'll probably see a reduction in per capita consumption, almost by definition. But that doesn't mean it works the other way. It doesn't mean that if you drive down per capita consumption by scaring moderate drinkers off alcohol, that you're going to have a reduction in heavy drinking. It's a basic fallacy.
Just two things. So I want to talk about the responsible drinker thing, because this is something that the anti-alcohol group absolutely hate as a term. But the WHO is pursuing what they're calling a denormalization strategy, which is what they did for tobacco. And the idea is that if you take it out of the public space, if you can't see it happening around you, then you will have no interest in doing it. It becomes unnatural for doing it. Is there any, I mean, this seemed to have worked extremely well for tobacco, or did it?
Well, there's a lot of things going on with tobacco. I mean, with tobacco, you had something that, well, the cigarettes specifically, you had a product that I don't think that many people actually thought it was good for you. I know people like to show the old adverts from the 30s of the doctors recommending Camels and so on. But they were known as coffin nails, and there was such a thing as tobacco heart in, over 100 years ago. So I don't know how many people actually thought cigarettes were good for you, but they didn't know it caused lung cancer. That obviously is true. So there, with cigarettes, you had this kind of sudden change from something that seemed to be a fairly ordinary commodity, as they might say, to something that's actually really dangerous for you. And as word got around that smoking caused lung cancer in particular, you saw a big drop in the smoking rate around the world. And that was before any particularly heavy-handed action from government. The only thing you really had up until the 90s, really, was public education campaigns and warnings on the packs. How much the stuff since then has had an effect, I mean, it's pretty clear to me that things like graphic warnings and plain packaging haven't worked, but the taxes almost certainly have. When they're at very high levels, basic economics, really, you're going to deter people from buying things.
Actually, that's a really interesting part of denormalization. So part of denormalization is actually stigmatizing users, because once you stigmatize users, you can do anything and nobody will raise a finger to help. And actually that's happened in Australia with tobacco taxes, that the tobacco taxes have become so high that Chinese smugglers have moved in. And it's now, there's now a big organised crime problem.
Yeah.
So it's prohibition under another name.
You see, certainly the effects of prohibition without even actually having prohibition, although they do have prohibition of e-cigarettes, which is not helping the whole tobacco turf war problem there.
Well, let's go back to the question of the responsible drinker, because when I read the literature of Movendi and these other groups, one of the things that they say is they say it's industry putting the onus back on people pretending that they're not selling them a harmful, addictive product. And this idea that there are moderate drinkers and there are heavy drinkers is just the industry covering its ass. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think that most people would just find that a ludicrous assertion. You're right that they do hate this concept of responsible drinking, because I don't know what it's like where you are, but, you know, in the UK, generally speaking, if you see a big billboard for alcohol, it'll say, please enjoy responsibly or please drink responsibly or something like that. And the public health lobby have said, and there's some truth in this, I guess, the public health lobby said, well, there's no definition of drinking responsibility. What do they mean by that? Which is fair enough. I mean, there isn't an actual categorization of it. But I think most people understand, broadly speaking, what that means. It means don't get drunk, basically. It means don't drink and drive. It means don't drink while you're pregnant. Now, whether telling people to drink responsibly actually makes them drink responsibly, I have no idea. But there is a real war on the concept of free will going on in public health, and it's getting worse every year, in which they just assert that it is the, in whatever industry it is the industry's responsibility if people misuse the product. And I say that it really isn't. Unless the industry is doing something willfully misleading, then it's absolutely the individual who's responsible for their own actions. I think it's very dangerous to claim otherwise.
It's interesting that the literature all says that the alcohol industry relies on heavy drinkers because of the Pareto principle. You sell more to heavy drinkers. And if you look at the wine trade, they're all busy begging people to buy better wines, you know. could you please drink less. And just drink better?
Well, right, yeah. I mean, the premiumization of alcohol, it has been the big story of the last 10 or 20 years in the actual industry. If these people actually bother to look at what happens in the industry rather than just treat them as kind of demonic entities, they would see that people are drinking less in a lot of countries, including Britain. But that's not doing the alcohol industry any harm, because they tend to be drinking more expensive alcohol. And the profit margin really, the industry does not make its profits particularly from alcoholics drinking very cheap cider. It makes its profits from people drinking premium spirits and wines.
Yeah. This actually brings up a point. When I've spent 6 months reading all of this stuff, listening to podcasts, and they all talk about big alcohol, and they talk about an alcohol industry that I certainly don't recognise. I've read some of the stuff that comes out of that London group, and they would be very happy for every vine in the world to be ripped up. They see it all as being the same thing.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a real misunderstanding, or is that a propaganda misunderstanding? It's just what they say because big alcohol sounds scary.
That's a good question, because you don't have a window into these people's souls. I mean, I've been reading recently a lot of their analysis of industry, you know, the unhealthy commodity industries. There's this growing literature.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. That's an interesting topic.
And it seems to me that, yeah, they probably do believe it, I guess. But, yeah, the demonization of the industry is nothing new in the temperance movement. If you look at the old anti-Saloon League posters from 100 years ago or more, it was very much about the liquor trust, as they called it. The demonization just of the saloon owner as well. There's always this big fat man at the saloon exploiting the workers. So the anti-industry aspect has always been strong. And it's quite compelling to people because, you know, as my friend Christian Nemitz recently wrote, he calls it anti-producerism as opposed to anti-consumerism. But if you frame these issues as being about the individual's right to buy whatever product they want to buy, then most people go, fair enough. But if you frame this as, corporations profiting from, these kind of unwitting dupes who are manipulated and tricked into buying products by, clever and aggressive advertising, then people are more sympathetic to their position, because people, for whatever reason, have an instinctive mistrust of business, and particularly of big corporations. So it's all about framing. But as I say, there's nothing new about it. And of course, they're borrowing in more recent times, they're borrowing directly from the whole big tobacco thing.
That raises an interesting point. When I look at some of the people who are the most you know, who are framing policy, many of them came out of the anti-tobacco background. And it seems very much that they're using the same techniques, which worked so well. I mean, they did work for tobacco, but they're bringing them to a lot of other things as well. Am I just imagining that? Is that a little conspiracy theory of mine? Or is it a lot of anti-tobacco lobbyists who find themselves out of work now who are moving on to other areas?
No, that's definitely happening to a large extent. I mean, the job with tobacco is not quite finished. But if you take, for example, Anna Gilmore. So there was an organisation in the UK called the UK Centre for Tobacco Control Studies. And after a few years, they changed the name to the UK Centre for Tobacco and Alcohol Studies. It's a pretty obvious example of mission crew. It wouldn't surprise me at all if they carried on, they would have got the word gambling in there or ultra-processed food or something. And the whole unhealthy commodity industry stuff, you know, this literature about unhealthy commodity industries, which came to a head with this bizarre report from WHO Europe a few months ago, in which they basically portrayed every industry pretty much as an unhealthy commodity industry, because every industry in some way can harm your health, even if it's like just the gig economy or Amazon or something. Oh, they're not paying enough wages, therefore they're harming people's health. So there is a very strong vein of anti-capitalism in this. But you're right. Actually, I mean, they are clearly borrowing from tobacco control, and they make no bones about it. I mean, they are explicitly saying this is essentially the same issue. It's the same with obesity. It's the same with gambling. And, of course, it's not the same thing. I mean, anti-smoking campaigners for many, many decades have gone to great lengths to point out that tobacco or cigarettes specifically are a unique product. And whenever someone like me said, oh, there's a slippery slope here, and before you know it, you're going to be demanding graphic warnings and alcohol, they would swear on a stack of Bibles that that would never happen because cigarettes are unique. And cigarettes, I agree, probably, you know, you can see them as unique for the kind of reasons I mentioned earlier on, that, you know, if they were invented today, they genuinely wouldn't be allowed on the market. People say that about alcohol too. I'm not quite sure that's true. But yeah, there was a different issue and quite a simple issue as well, you've got to remember, because cigarettes, you know, the link between cigarettes and lung cancer was very, very strong. If you reduce the sale of cigarettes, then you will reduce lung cancer in society. And you can see this very clearly on any number of graphs looking at lung cancer rates and smoking rates over the last 100 years. The same is not true of alcohol, which can be drunk, not just safely, but actually gives you health benefits from drinking at certain levels. And it's certainly not true of things like obesity, which is a vastly more complicated area, or something like gambling. These are all very different issues, but they treat them all the same, because when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Yeah, let's talk about that WHO document. So I found that an extraordinary document. It was called something like The Commercial Determinants of Health. Now, I was for 12 years the editor of an international magazine, as in we looked at the international world of wine. And I learned very early on what is a real trend in what is not. So writers would say, you know, vineyards are being ripped out in Bordeaux, California and Australia. And go, okay, that's a trend, because it's all happening for the same reason. But then somebody would say, well, they're selling tequila in the United States and they're selling gin in Britain and they're selling this. Well, that's not a trend. They're all completely different things happening for completely different reasons. Mm. And that document took the second approach. It took things that had nothing to do with one another, pulled them all together and said, see, these companies are nefarious and they need to be shut down. I mean, they criticised infant formula for companies donating it to a war zone.
Yeah.
They criticised pharmaceuticals for not supplying patented drugs for free. They threw in tobacco control in Kyrgyzstan, I think, where there's tobacco smuggling or something. And I was like, you can't be serious. I actually found that a profoundly shocking document, but it got into the Financial Times. I mean, what makes people write things like that? Do you have any insight?
That document was the product of a fairly small clique of mostly British academics, public health academics, who I think can fairly be described as zealots and hardliners. They've been working on this literature for about the last 10 years. It's an echo chamber, really. The whole thing is based on what I can only imagine is a willful misunderstanding. So they have this idea that there is the tobacco playbook, right? Now, It's fair to say there probably was a tobacco playbook. If you define it properly, if you look at the tobacco industry's response to the early evidence in the 1950s that smoking caused lung cancer, there was a strategy that was thrashed out between the tobacco companies, which was basically, we're not going to explicitly deny this because that could leave us in legal trouble later, but we're going to support anybody who is going to cast doubt on it. And they fought on for a very long time on that basis. Now, that is a tobacco playbook, and some people have accused other industries of using the same playbook in areas where they, you know, the campaigners accuse the industry of causing harm and accuse the industry of covering it up. Okay, so that's a specific kind of definition of it. So the National Football League in America has been accused of using the tobacco playbook. The marijuana industry has been accused of using it. The 5G or mobile phone industries. You know, these are all people who think that these products are causing diseases, usually cancer. And because the industry deny it, they're accused of using the industry playbook. Okay, fine. But that's not what these academics are talking about. They're saying that the industry, the tobacco industry, has used the following six tactics. So it's things like lobbying. It's things like litigation. Now, if you look at these six so-called tobacco industry strategies, nearly all of them have been extensively used, not just by every other industry, but by pretty much any civil society organization engaging in political activity, including the public health groups themselves. Public health groups lobby all the time. They form coalitions, which is meant to be a tobacco playbook thing. You know, it's the stuff that they're accusing the tobacco industry and therefore every other industry now of doing are just routine political strategies that anyone would use. But they say, well, that's the tobacco playbook. Then they look at alcohol and say, well, we've looked at all these submissions to some consultation in Australia, and we found that they use most of the same strategies that the tobacco industry used, and then they apply it to gambling and so on. And that's what the WHO report was the culmination of, in which they're saying, well, all these industries use the tobacco playbook, and we should exclude them from the policymaking process. That's the end game here. That's what they want. They want to exclude industry and anybody associated with industry, which would include the IEA in their eyes, and anyone at kind of a seventh degree of separation. They want to exclude them from the policymaking process. And the reason they want to do that is because there isn't really any grassroots opposition to what they're doing, and also, incidentally, there's no grassroots support for what they're doing either in terms of organized collective action. If you get rid of the industry voices and anybody associated with industry, they have a completely free rein. They're not going to have any opposition. So they can speak to politicians, they can say whatever they want, and no one can gainsay them. That's what they want to do. That's ultimately what all this nonsense about the playbook is actually about.
Yeah, I mean, this is becoming a real problem for alcohol because there's a lot of studies that show that moderate drinking is good for you. And it's very easy to discredit them by saying, well, tobacco produced all of these reports and they're doing the same thing. But of course, they're not the same thing at all. Let's just stay on the group of academics. It seems to me, when I look up the names for who was in Canada, who's on the USDA guidelines, who's in Europe, they're all the same people. Is this just because experts hang out together and it's a small world? Or, you know, how does this ecosystem of public health experts function?
It's partly that there's not that many of them. I mean, there's quite a few, obviously. But yeah, you're right that the main people like Tim Stockwell seem to show up everywhere. And particularly if it involves the, you know, various guidelines committees around the world. He's not actually on the new one in America, but his close colleague Tim Naimi is. He's another guy who pops up all the time. Petra Mayer keeps popping up all the time. She's in the UK. I mean, they found a way to get their hands on a great deal of money is basically what it comes down to. There is a lot of money out there for public health research. And Anna Gilmore has got her hands on millions of pounds of it in various different ways. So she runs something called the Spectrum Consortium, which got £6 million from the UK Prevention Research Partnership a few years ago. Petra Mayer, who was, she's actually until recently was president of the Kettle Brewn Society. Tim Stockwell in the 80s was president of the Kettle Brewn, sorry, in the 90s. No, noughties.
No, it was earlier. It was later.
Yeah, it was 2005, 2007, I think. The Kettle Brewn Society is very interesting because it kind of is a bridge between the traditional temperance movement and modern public health. And we've already talked about kind of gospel temperance. The reality is there isn't really much difference between what the traditional temperance groups want to do and what modern public health academics want to do. They're all, you know, the kettle brewed vision of alcohol control, the whole population approach, the single distribution theory, all this kind of stuff, it has been completely adopted by pretty much every major public health organization, including the WHO, which when you think about it is pretty insane, because this is a fairly harebrained theory dreamt up by a few fairly obscure sociologists in the 1970s and 1980s, and yet it is now the dominant way of looking at the issue. And one of the reasons it's become so dominant is because it suits everybody. It suits everybody in public health and in the temperance lobby. It suits grandstanding politicians, for that matter, because it says that the government is the solution to this, and all you need to do is just drive down rates of drinking in the same way that you drove down rates of smoking. So it appeals to lots of different people. Going back to the academics, yeah, there's a small group of them. They all think basically the same thing. If you go into this field not, you know, thinking that, then it won't be long before you find that you kind of have to if you want to have a career in it. That's really the bottom line.
Using the principle of charity, do you think that these are people who are motivated to mitigate alcohol harms and they see this as the best way to do it?
I mean, some of them, for sure, yeah. And no doubt that's why some of them got into it in the first place. I mean, the older I get, the more cynical I get, actually. And I tend to think that a very large part of it is just about, you know, following the money.
Following grants. And when you say money, we're talking here about academic and government grants.
Yeah, academic and, both. I mean, there are large grant-making bodies that will dish out money to people like Anna Gilmore and Petromare, you know, in the millions of pounds. The Department of Health, the European Commission, the Scottish Government, the Scandinavian retail monopolies. That's very interesting. That, you know, the whole kettle brewing movement, the Purple Book as it's known, the Robin Room, all these people who were sociologists or statisticians in the 1970s, they started going to these meetings in Scandinavia. And they started getting money from the Scandinavian retail monopolies. Why were the Scandinavian retail monopolies funding these people? Because they wanted to make the case for more government intervention in the alcohol market. Right?
I just need to interject in this and explain what we're talking about. So the Scandinavian countries or the Nordic countries of Finland, Norway and Sweden all have government control of alcohol. They're sold through government stores. So Systembolaget in Sweden, Van Monopoly in Norway and Alko in Finland. And one of the reasons that the governments like this is because they're not just earning money from tax, they're also earning revenue from the sale of alcohol.
Yeah.
Sorry, I cut you off.
No, exactly right. Yeah, you're right to explain that. And so their motivation is, well, put it this way, at any given time, one of these countries could elect a government or have a referendum to overturn the alcohol retail monopoly, right? The people in Scandinavia are well aware that they're outliers and that most of Europe gets on perfectly well with a normal private free market system in alcohol. And they might fancy a bit more choice. The Swedish system, Blåga, I don't know if you've ever been there, it's actually pretty good for choice. It has to be, because if it was really restrictive, then people would turn against the existing system. But the government and the retail monopolies themselves have an incentive to fund research that makes a kind of a free market approach to alcohol look bad and dangerous.
And indeed, both Tim Stockwell and Tim Namey have done that research on behalf of the monopolies as well. And so they make the claim that they have been paid by alcohol.
I mean, yeah, they're funded by the state, I guess. Yeah, in a sense, they're funded by alcohol. Vivendi actually also gets money from the, I think it's Finland's lottery. Which is
kind of, no, it's a Swedish lottery.
The Swedish lottery. Yeah, yeah. So kind of interesting that they get their money from gambling, which I'm not sure their founders would be that happy with. But I mean, I'm not too worried about Stockwell's conflicts of interest. I mean, unlike him, I don't assume that people just do whatever the funder says. What I'm interested in is how these people have managed to make a living from doing what they're doing. And to make a living, obviously, you need to get grant funding. And to get grant funding, you need to approach this issue in a particular way, basically. If you go in and say, well, I want to take a libertarian approach to this, you're just not going to get funding from the European Commission or the Department of Health.
I spoke to Professor Raymond Estrick, and he's been running a trial called PREDIMED, which is about the Mediterranean diet, and he said there are no grants possible in Europe any longer to study potential health benefits of wine. You can only do it if you roll it into another study, like talking about the Mediterranean diet.
Right.
There's zero chance of getting any money.
So that then leaves you, of course, if you want to do this study, where are you going to go looking for money?
Well, you can't do it from private industry, because that was tried and that got shut down because obviously if private industry is funding it, it's going to be pro-alcohol.
So you're stuck. If you can't get state funding, unless you can find some wealthy benefactor, you can't do it.
So let's talk about some of the research. You've been scathing in some of your recent articles. So there's been a whole lot of papers released recently. The Stockwell and Namy paper last year, a re-release of it that came out in June. There's been a recent paper about dementia and alcohol, and you've been and a Lancet report about dementia and alcohol, and you've been highly critical of all of these. On what basis?
Well, the Stockwell ones, and you're right, they're really just, he just keeps rewriting them and excluding more and more studies. I mean, the recent Stockwell one is just absurd. I mean, it actually came out in January. It wasn't press released until a few weeks ago, which I think is because the deadline for the consultation on the US drinking guidelines was coming to an end, and he wanted a bit of publicity. I think that's probably what it was, because the study itself was just dreadful. So I saw the headline before I saw the study, and I saw the headline, one drink a day could kill you, whatever. And I thought, I bet that's Tim Stockwell. I clicked on the link. Yep, it's Tim Stockwell. And I thought, I bet this is a cherry-picked study. Looked at the study. He refined the number of studies he was looking at from over 3,000 to 5. I mean, the cherry picking was just so blatant. He cited the 5 studies he did actually consider to be credible. He miscited all 5 of them, but I worked out which ones they were. And they were a mixed bag. It wasn't like they even particularly supported his position. So even getting rid of literally 99.9% of the evidence, he still didn't have a very compelling story to tell. But yeah, this guy's been doing this since 2006, when, maybe not coincidentally, he was president of the Kettle Brewing Society. In 2000, he wrote an article more or less saying that it wasn't even worth doing any more research into the area of moderate drinking, because it's so obvious that the benefits exist. They've been proven time and time again. We know from animal research, we know from biological research, and he described people who doubted it as being flat earthers. A few years later, he's at Kettle Brewing saying...
Well, hang on a second. This keeps coming up in these conversations, and I always bring up two things. So first of all, the first article I ever wrote about wine and health was back in 2004, and Tim Stockwell was very pleasant and very helpful. He sent me statistics on how many lives were saved, how many lives were lost from alcohol. But doesn't it speak well of somebody if they take a position and then through evidence or whatever, they change their mind? Shouldn't we take somebody more seriously if they hold a position and then they decide to change their mind?
Well, it depends why they've changed their mind, or even if they actually have changed their mind. I mean, there's nothing that he's produced in his numerous kind of systematic reviews that is remotely persuasive, to me at least, that the benefits of moderate drinking aren't as robust as he thought they were in 2000. It seems to me that for whatever reason, he's taken a more political stance on this, and that the alcohol research community in general is not very happy with the fact that moderate drinking is good for you, because they find it politically awkward. I think it's very interesting why they're so obsessed with the benefits of moderate drinking, because I'm not particularly interested in them. It's not the reason I drink. I don't drink moderately anyway, and I don't think many people are drinking because of the health benefits. It's not something that I would particularly go to the wall for. It doesn't matter to me. If there's no benefits, no health benefits from moderate drinking, I would still defend alcohol as much as I do at the moment, because it's the social benefits of alcohol that are really worth having. That's why people drink. And even if one drink a month was dangerous, I would still defend people's right to do it, because they're grown-ups and they're allowed to assume a certain amount of risk. So it's not important to the liberal position. Alcohol hasn't got anything to do with the benefits of moderate drinking. What interests me is why they're so obsessed with trying to erase them. And I think the reason is because if they erase them, they can go around saying no save level, which you're already doing, which is a phrase directly taken from tobacco control, and it helps the tobacconization of this issue, which is really what they're after. So I think that I don't know whether he's genuinely changed his mind or not, but it is certainly in keeping with the general political stance of these kind of anti-alcohol researchers to disparage and downplay the benefits of moderate drinking for political reasons so that they can make a very simple, bold statement about alcohol, which is basically that alcohol in any quantity is bad, which is what the temperance lobby have been saying for 200 years.
Yeah, and I mean, now they found the word cancer, which is a, you know, a terrifying word, you know, and so a lot of literature now is, well, even if it gives you these cardiovascular benefits, you're still going to die from cancer if you touch it. So let's talk about cancer warning labels. This is being trialled in Ireland next year. There was an experiment done in Yukon in Canada. It looks like alcohol warnings are going to come to alcohol bottles. What's the evidence that these kinds of labels work or don't work?
I don't really know because I'm not sure anyone's tried them before. Possibly somewhere in Canada has given them a go.
They did, and the level of alcohol consumption dropped, but they didn't say who stopped.
You mentioned it before, right? I would instinctively guess that this is going to reduce consumption of alcohol by the worried well and by people who are not heavy drinkers in the first place. I find it very interesting they're focusing on cancer, for one thing, because at least half of alcohol-related deaths have nothing to do with cancer. It's liver cirrhosis. Liver cirrhosis is by far the thing to worry about when it comes to drinking. You have to drink a great deal of it for a very long time to get liver cirrhosis, but that is the big killer when it comes to alcohol, followed by, I guess, accidents and drink driving. So why are they not calling for warning saying, you know, heavy drinking causes liver cirrhosis? I think it's, again, they're copying the anti-smoking movement. They just look to what the anti-smoking movement did in the 60s. They put, you know, cancer warnings on the packs. They think we're just going to do that. And it sounds scarier. And incidentally, the evidence that, the one they really focus on is breast cancer, because supposedly there's no safe level when it comes to breast cancer. Well, actually, if you look at the evidence, the epidemiological evidence, it is vastly weaker than the evidence that there are health benefits from moderate drinking. And yet that's considered to be settled science. And even their Mendelian randomization studies can't find a link between alcohol and breast cancer. So there's a double standard all the time with this stuff.
I've been doing a story about alcohol and cancer, and I spoke to a research oncologist a few weeks ago who said the breast cancer link was quite weak. He said the one for, I think it was esophageal or mouth cancer, was very strong. But but the one for breast cancer, he actually said he was surprised at how weak the link was because it's the one that we hear about the most.
It's very weak. And also I think there are, you know, compelling reasons to think that the evidence is confounded by other variables. You know, when you talk about the benefits of moderate drinking, all sorts of excuses come out from people like Tim Stockwell. Oh, it's sick quitters. It's confounded by this. These people are just inherently less healthy and so on. All this stuff has been tested to destruction. But with breast cancer, for example, a big risk factor for breast cancer is not having kids.
Postmenopausal and obesity as well.
Yeah, I think it's quite possible that people who don't have kids drink more than people who do, you know, but nobody's going around.
I'm saying nothing in response to that.
But yeah, no, these people aren't going around saying, well, we need to test it for this, we need to test it for this. As soon as you find a risk with alcohol in any epidemiological study, it is considered settled. The WHO says that alcohol causes 200 distinct different diseases. I'd love to see how strong the evidence for all that stuff is. It won't be as strong as the evidence that moderate drinking reduces heart disease, I'm sure.
So let's go back to the Tim Stockwell study and the cherry picking. You know, you're not the first person to tell me that. I've had scientists tell me off the record what they think of it. One described it as a statistical black box, that she couldn't actually work out the statistical methods that he'd used.
Yeah.
And yet he's been quoted 5 times in the New York Times. It's been all over the Guardian. The Guardian's written a couple of stories about it. Even, you know, the editor of New Scientist put it into New Scientist. So who are you or I to criticise something
something that science reporters are all... I mean, I watched him give a presentation to Edinburgh University and nobody raised their hand and said, hang on a second, that doesn't sound right. So who are you or who am I to criticise this?
Well, if this was complicated science, you would be right that, you know, only a scientist would be qualified to talk about it. But since this is just, you know, fairly crude observational epidemiology, and you can see how many studies he started out with, and you can see how many he's left with, and you can see him chipping away at these studies until eventually he finds the result he wants. I think anybody who is, you know, reasonably intelligent and can read a study is qualified to critique it. And as you say, there are plenty of scientists, maybe off the record, but there are plenty of scientists prepared to say that this doesn't stack up as well.
Well, actually, in the wake of the collapse of the MACH trial in America, which was the one that industry funded, it's really hard to get scientists to talk on the record now. I've heard stories about people being bullied, that if they were pro that trial, they don't get grant funding anymore. It's been quite extraordinary. Aside from that, which is me being conspiracy theory a little bit, why now? Why are we seeing? Why is this? What has been, I think, fairly described as shoddy research all over the newspapers? What is it about this moment that is working?
Well, the newspapers love it. I mean, to be fair, the newspapers love reporting stories showing that, you know, a glass of wine a day reduces your risk of dying as well. I mean, they just regularly report these studies. And they probably give Stockwell a disproportionate amount of attention because I guess it's... Yeah, it's man bites dog, isn't it? You know, it's that's the contrarian position, and everything you thought you knew was wrong is the kind of message. So, newspapers just like reporting this kind of stuff. Newspapers, I guess, like bad news more than they like good news, but, you know, most of their readers will drink alcohol, and it's the kind of thing that they will, you know, they'll not turn the page. They'll read the story. So you can't blame the journalists for reporting it. I think you can fairly blame people like Tim Stockwell for propagating this stuff. As far as I can see, the reason he just keeps producing basically the same piece of research again and again and again, never does any original research himself, is he's just trying to clog up the search engines and he's trying to get enough headlines so that the relatively unengaged casual reader gets the impression that there is no safe level of alcohol. It's just a matter of repeating this message, which is not really what scientists do generally. Scientists like to move on and do something else, but this guy just keeps repeating himself because I don't think the aim is to extend human understanding. I think the aim is political.
So when you write your articles, do you get any response from readers? Are people like, yeah, we've got somebody defending my right to drink, or is it dead silence out there?
No, I get emails from people. Yeah, I've got a Substack now. You know, there's comments.
I know, it's a great Substack. I'm going to put that in the show notes. Thanks. As well. Okay, some final thoughts. Just briefly, when I've spoken about this issue to people, one thing that people in wine always say to me, it's almost like clockwork. They say, why aren't they going after sugar? Why aren't they going after ultra processed foods? To which I say, they are. Yeah. The public health lobby has morphed into a many tentacled monster almost that's using the anti-tobacco playbook against a multitude of things. And somebody said to me that they should have warning labels on, you know, chocolate bars and stuff. And I said, we're going to have a day one day where we're going to have warning labels in patisseries. And she's like, that's ridiculous. I said, no, I don't think it is ridiculous. Am I wrong? Am I indulging in conspiracy theories? Or what's your view of this growing public health commercial determinants of health movement?
Well, everyone who's warned about a slippery slope for the last 30 years has been proven right so far, and probably been proven right even more quickly than they expected. So I don't think at this stage there's any kind of reductio or ad absurdum prediction you can make that is completely off the table. These guys are going after everything that, you know, libertarians said they would go after, and they're using exactly the same tools. And you're right, by the way, to say it's an anti-tobacco playbook, which is why I think it's, you know, when these academics talk about the tobacco playbook, it's just projection. They're accusing these other industries of doing the same thing as tobacco when they're not, because these academics themselves are doing exactly what they did to smokers and to the tobacco industry. So that's pure projection. You know, it's really not helpful when one group of consumers decides that the best way to defend their interests is to just kind of point the finger at another group of consumers. Yeah. And they're using exactly the same tactics to do it. All I try and do is just shine a light on those tactics and the dodgy claims and the dubious science that's been promoted to pursue it. But we really need a change in the climate of opinion in general, that I think we are becoming in the Western world increasingly intolerant of each other, increasingly bigoted, increasingly puritanical. And so no wonder everything gets caught up in it. But at the end of the day, you know, if you it's possible for groups of people to, you know, demonize another group of people and you know, kind of hope that they'll be last. But if you have that kind of intolerance in society, everybody ultimately loses. You know, it's a bit like the debate about free speech. People can pick on different types of speech that they don't like and certain people that should be protected. But you just gradually start banning different forms of speech and until eventually everybody is negatively affected by it. There's something that everybody can't say. And that's how I see this lifestyle, you know, problem going, that, you know, it's fine. You know, throw the smokers under the bus, throw the sugary drink consumers under the bus, throw the gamblers under the bus because I'm not one of these people. Well, they will come for you. I think the ultra-processed food issue has made that very clear. I mean, ultra-processed food covers a vast, vast range of food products, probably more than most people realize. If they were to use tobacco control tactics against ultra-processed food, there would be barely anybody who would not be adversely affected by it. So I think people in general just need to, even for their own long-term self-interest, just to live and let live.
All right. On that gloomy note, thank you very much, Chris Snowden, for appearing on the podcast.
It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.